wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. Jada, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And we're doing another extended single topic breakdown this week after the Ernest Rutherford breakdown last week on a related topic, right? Quantum mechanics, quantum computing. What is quantum? What is a quantum? What does it mean?
So we're talking about quantum physics, in quantum technology, which uses principles of quantum physics. And what it kind of relates to what Alan was talking about last week, where he was talking about atoms and these subatomic particles, right? Talking about the splitting of the atom by Ernest Rutherford. So once they started to understand atoms and these subatomic particles a bit more, they started making observations, and it doesn't behave like what we're used to, right? They're these tiny, tiny, tiny little bodies. These particles don't follow the same laws of physics that we're used to as big things. And so they needed to start thinking, theorizing, trying to explain these observations. And so about 100 years ago, emerged the theory of quantum physics, right? And so because it's 100 years ago, we're now celebrating that this year with the International Year of Quantum Science and Technology.
Wow, big year.
Yeah, which actually launches today.
So in Paris, very exciting.
At 10 a.m. our time tonight, 10 p.m., sorry, they will launch the UNESCO International Year of Quantum Science and Technology to celebrate this.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah, and so it's basically, as we said, it's like dealing with how the physics of atoms and subatomic particles. There's a lot of people around the world researching this, and surprisingly, there's a high density of researchers in New Zealand that are working in quantum mechanics and adapting these things to quantum technologies. We've even got a centre called TFAO, Dodwell Centre for Photonic and Quantum Technologies, that researches in this space.
So it's a big deal for everywhere, but also us.
Yeah. And so basically, yeah, quantum technology, which the government has decided is one of its priorities in its science funding recently, is all about using these quantum mechanics to do stuff. And so I'm contextualizing it in terms of computing, communication, and sensing today.
Yeah.
So quantum computers, this is probably the thing that most people have heard of, right?
Yeah, if we're talking quantum, that's one of the first things that comes to mind
Right, yeah. And so a quantum computer, it's not going to replace, or very, very unlikely to replace a classical computer that we're used to. Just because they're four different things, right? They fundamentally work in a different way. And so they're not going to be all appropriate for all problems that we have. You know, classical computers are still going to have its place. But... yeah, there's a lot of development going on. One of the primary differences that you'll read about or see when people start talking quantum versus classical is this idea of bits versus qubits, right? So a good analogy that I recently saw is if you think of a sphere, if you're a classical computer, you could stand at the north or the south pole, zero or one. Right. Whereas if you're a quantum computer, you could be anywhere on that surface.
Right.
So there's just a lot more to deal with in ways of doing computational calculations and everything. So there's a lot of different ways to approach problems. So one part of quantum computing is people have to work out different algorithms and the ways to actually do these calculations. But they also have to work out how to make these qubits, make them stable, so that we can actually use them.
Right.
So if you've ever looked on Google, you go on quantum computer and you looked at the images, what you'll probably see is something that might have this really small square somewhere in the picture that's actually the chip with the qubits and stuff, and then there's all this gold and there's all these little wires and fiber and all this stuff. And all that stuff around the little bit that's doing a lot of the work is just cooling. You have to cool these things to almost minus 273 degrees Celsius.
That's quite cold.
That's quite cold,
yeah,
right?
That's really almost as cold as it can get, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, we're very close.
Yeah, we're very close to absolute zero. So we're not at the level where these quantum computers are going to be sitting in your back pocket.
No.
Like your phone with your more classical computer, right?
Mm.
And so there's a lot of research going on about how to make these quantum computers in different ways so that you can avoid this cooling, or a lot of the times this cooling is all about keeping them stable, because you have these qubits, but they've got to stay in the same state for a reasonable amount of time so you can do your calculations and stuff.
Right.
And so there's a whole bunch of ways that people are looking at doing this around the world. They've basically come down to how you make the qubits. So there's superconducting, trapped ion, neutral atoms, quantum dots. And so that's just the different ways you make these qubits. And so lots and lots of research going on. There's no quantum computers in New Zealand. There is a company, the Australian government last year invested a lot of money into a company that's developing one. But, you know, you've got your big players like IBM and Google and Intel and stuff all have quantum computing divisions. What we do in New Zealand, though, is we do have researchers who are doing research and developing technologies that can be components of your quantum computers. So at Otago, there's a group led by Harold Schwefel. I'll probably pronounce that wrong, sorry. And so a lot of these, well, some of these quantum computers work in the microwave regime, right? And that's part of why you need all this cooling, because there's a lot of background. And so you need to cool so you don't have this background so that you can have this nice stable signal. And then if you think of a future where you want to connect these computers up, how are you going to do that? Are you going to have to cool the whole system? Like, this starts to become really difficult,
right? Yeah, it seems quite complex.
So what if you could convert those microwaves to optical photons? So, and we know you get your internet by fiber, right? It's all just optical. So we already have a lot of technology.
We're utilizing the existing stuff.
Yeah. And so they're looking at how ways that they can shift these microwave signals to optical signals so that they can start to make things like quantum internet, you know, closer to reality.
Mm.
And this was actually, they managed to actually get some funding from Google last year towards this idea. So it's generated a lot of excitement.
Yeah.
The other thing that's also going on at led out of Otago, out of a group of Jevon Longdale, is they're developing these crystals that are doped with rare earth elements called europium and erbium.
Ooh.
And it's basically to make memory, right? Because you need, if you're using your light as your in your system and you need to trap it in some sort of quantum state, so you know your qubit is stable and it's trapped and it lasts for a long period of time, this is one of the ways you can do it. And I didn't look up if they still hold the record, but they used to hold the record for having the longest storage time, that where everything stayed stable. And then you've also got people at Victoria University who are looking at other materials called rare earth nitrides to do a similar thing with these, having this memory for these quantum
Right.
Records.
So in New Zealand, we could basically, I mean, aside from the quantum computer part, we've got all the rest of the bits.
Yeah, we're helping out with the bits, right? So, you know, like we're always going to, there'll be international collaborations. Mm. Like a lot of these projects are already part of international collaborations, and we're working with people to make this computer. But, okay, so people are struggling to make these computers, but why? Like, what are they going to do with them?
Yeah, what can we do with a quantum
and
computer?
Then, so I kind of just, again, put this into Google, see what I throw up. And it was a really funny title of, from May 2023, it was a Nature Spotlight article by this guy, Michael Brooks, and it was like, quantum computers, what are they good for? For now, absolutely nothing. But researchers and firms are optimistic about applications. So as I said, IBM, Google, Microsoft, Intel, lots of these companies, they have their own quantum computing divisions. There's lots of companies that are just to make a quantum computer. You've got companies like Airbus, Volkswagen, JP Chase, which all have divisions which are actively like looking at what problems they could solve with these things. So there is a lot of energy around this. And so these things like already the really most basic form of quantum computer, which is called a quantum annealer, can do some optimization problems. So like one of the examples I saw was you can improve the cargo loading within passenger planes. So you're just optimizing, you know, space. And so, you know, like that has benefits for sustainability and such down the line. If we can get the quantum computer working as the researchers want, then it's things like drug discovery, material science, finance always gets in there too. So financial modeling and trading and stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's those sort of things. And this is why we're aiming to have these quantum computers.
Big for modeling things with lots of factors, I'm guessing.
Exactly, right. So if you think of drug discovery, those are molecules that have lots of atoms. They all can move a little bit. It becomes too much for, like, we can do a certain amount of modeling with classical computing. But if we have these quantum computers in this fundamentally different way of doing things, then it's should be, we can have bigger systems.
Yeah. So moving forward with quantum computing, I mean, seems to have several major uses.
And you can, if you think back to when classical computing started, I doubt any of those people really ever thought that they would be like, you know, the size of your phone.
Yeah, so, pick it up, take it around. Yeah.
Yeah, and so then moving on from quantum computing, there is quantum communication. And I was doing a bit of a search to see how to, like, more easily describe this kind of thing. And so full credit to a PhD student at University of York in the Institute for Safe Autonomy, who has a video up on the Department of for Science, Innovation and Tech in the UK's YouTube channel, where she gave probably one of the best explanations of quantum communication that I've seen to date. And basically she started with, it's not based on solving hard problems, but on the physical laws that it's impossible to violate.
Right.
Right. And so this communication is, so when we think about when we want to talk to other people, it's often about sending light. So you think, you know, you might be in a room and you blink at someone to kind of send them a message.
Yeah.
Now, if you think about Morse code, that was just blinking in a certain pattern that you've agreed on that's sending a certain message, right? But because, you know, like we could also think of it, you know, we're sending pulses of light rather than blinking. You know, if we're in the real world and you're doing this over a certain distance, there's a lot of distance that people can intercept that and look at it, right? And we don't really know that they've looked at it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is how you can have, you know, spy stuff. But with quantum communication, because what you do now is you're just using a single photon or a single particle, and these are governed by these quantum physical laws, which I'm not going to get into today, that means that once it's touched, it changes. And so they always use this example of Alice and Bob. I don't know where the names Alice and Bob came from, but I really need to look in the history of this analogy once because it kind of fascinates me. And it's about Alice wants to send signal to, or she wants to talk to Bob, so she wants to send a signal. And so she sends this single photon out, and Bob gets it. He touches it, it changes, but that's okay because Bob was supposed to get this message, right? But say Alice sends this, and some nefarious person intercepts it in between. Now that they've touched it, they've changed it. So by the time Bob gets it, he knows something's happened and it's changed. And so you know that someone's either spying on you, they've changed your message, you know, like you start to get suspicious. And so obviously this is, you know, in security applications, this has value. And it's referred to as quantum key distribution. And it has actually been used, the first time it was used, it was in 2004 for a bank transfer in Vienna, Austria. And then in 2007, Geneva actually transmitted their ballots for the Swiss national election using quantum encryption technology. So I thought that was quite cool. Problem is, at the moment, it is limited in terms of distance.
Yeah,
we can't do it for it because it is only a single photon, so it kind of peters out.
Right.
So the numbers I kind of found is that they've kind of 800, 1,000 kilometres. I did see a report that was much more from just the start of this year, but I only found one article and it wasn't a research paper, so I'm a bit sus about that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so there's a lot, obviously, of development in that space. And
I wonder if Alice and Bob are a person A, person B type situation, maybe.
I never thought of that.
Just get names.
Yeah.
After that. Yeah. And then quantum sensing.
So sensing, this is basically sensing for anything and everything kind of thing. So magnetic, thermal, pressure, gas sensing. So that example where I was talking about the microwave to optical conversion.
Yeah.
They're also looking at using that for atmospheric gas sensing because the idea of this technology that you can use, you could actually maybe, with a lot of engineering still to go, put it on a CubeSat rather than having a massive satellite that you've got to put up. So that's one of the areas they're interested in. Also, magnetic fields are really useful, quantum tech for sensing magnetic fields, particularly using a technology called optically pumped magnetometers. So basically, in essence, what it is you kind of have a box that's filled with gaseous atoms. And those atoms have some sort of property to them. So they often are potassium, cesium, or rubidium.
Right.
And what you can do is you shine laser light at those atoms, and they all get excited to some state that's the same. So they're all, you know, acting the same way.
Yeah.
And if you put them in a magnetic field, then they all change in that some same way, and you can use another light to measure that change. And so by observing that change, you can start to measure how strong is that magnetic field. You might get direction and stuff like this. And so you have a really, really, really sensitive sensor for magnetic fields.
Yeah.
What's also really cool is it actually measures over a wide range. So sometimes the problem with when we measure stuff, it can be great for a range of values, but it can't go higher or can't go smaller and stuff. Whereas these are really nice in that they actually do a wide range. But why do we care? Like, why
do I need to check magnetic fields?
Exactly, right. So the Earth has a magnetic field. We have a north and south pole, right? So these sensors could be used to actually map that magnetic field in a lot more detail. And so you can then use this to find magnetic anomalies and explore for natural resources.
Ah, right.
Also, you can also use that information, though, for navigation. So you no longer need GPS. We're not going to get rid of GPS, but you're not bound to having a satellite connection to multiple satellites for your GPS signal, because you've got your magnetic field measurements, and you've previously had this map of the Earth's magnetic field.
Wow.
Space exploration, again, because they can be made small and light, you can use them on your satellites and such to measure planet magnetic field or solar activity. But the one that I learned about just last year when I went to a conference that I find really exciting is magnetoencephalology.
Ooh.
That's a hard one. It's about studying the magnetic fields in your brain.
Ooh.
And so they already do this because when you think and you act and you do stuff, like, you know, your neurons fire and all this, and there's slight changes in the magnetic fields. And they're tiny compared to the Earth's magnetic field. They're absolutely tiny. And so researchers already do this sort of stuff. But the technology they use, it's, again, really interesting if you do an image search. Basically, the person being studied, whose brain's been studied, they would sit in this chair and they'll probably have a screen in front of them, which is the stimuli that they're using in the study. And their head is in the bottom of what I can best describe as a big can.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Because, like, the technology that's used, again, has to be really, really cold, right? And so they have to basically have this big canister of liquid, liquid helium and liquid nitrogen. And so what this then means is this person has to sit relatively still. It can only be adults because you don't make these things for kids.
Yeah.
And they actually have to have a head that's about the right size. So not everyone can be studied.
It's a specific selection process.
Exactly, right? Not the most convenient if you're trying to, like, because, you know, like, they're trying to study, you know, what's happening in the brain when people with epilepsy and neurological conditions like this.
Right.
So because we have now this quantum technology, these optically pumped magnetometers, is that they can actually now have, like, a cap that goes over the person's head and you just plug these sensors in.
Oh, way easier.
Way easier, right?
That seems far more convenient.
Exactly. And so now you can do it on kids. Now you can have it on adults with all sorts of sized heads.
And not
all this cooling. You do still have to do it in a shielded room. So this was what was really interesting to me as well, because the magnetic field they're trying to sense is so much smaller than the Earth's magnetic field and just background urban magnetic field. So you've got to shield the room to get rid of just that background signal so that you can see.
Right.
And so there is actually a lab in Australia that opened this year, because they took a while to get their magnetic shielding sorted, and now they're going to be able to start doing these studies.
Yeah, lots of big news there in Australia.
Yeah.
And lots of applications for quantum physics, quantum mechanics that we're seeing develop and maybe being developed and hopefully future becoming develops. Is that the right word? Developing?
Developing.
Yeah,
I think that might
be the correct call.
Yeah, I think quantum can either be a very scary word, or it's like people start thinking Ant-Man and the quantum realm or whatever it was. But I think as we're within the next sort of 10, 20 years, I think we'll see a lot more technology come out that we become a lot more familiar with.
Yeah, very exciting news. Maybe we'll be seeing our quantum, maybe not smartphones, but maybe a quantum computer we could visit ourselves in
the
next 5 to 10 years, hopefully, in Aotearoa. All right, thank you for sharing all this quantum information with us, with maybe a slightly more basic form of communication, but great nonetheless. Thanks for you, as always, for coming in. Thank you, Moshat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Moshat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.